Senate Judiciary, be in order, please. Secretary will take the roll.
Vice Chair McGilvery.
Here.
Vice Chair Sands.
Here.
Senator S.
Here.
Senator Heinbaugh.
Here.
Senator Bennett.
Here.
Senator Manzella.
Here.
Senator Weber.
Here.
Senator Brown.
Here.
Senator Friedel.
Here.
Senator Gross.
Here.
Chairman Regeer.
Here. Committee, we have a couple of Senate resolutions and two Senate bills we're going to hear this morning, and then hopefully do a little executive action after that. Those of you that are here to testify, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And if you're going to testify, there's a sign-up sheet by the door if you would sign up there. And whether you are testifying online or in person, give us your name when you begin and spell your last name. Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, could you please tell us what bills you're considering for executive action today? Thank you.
Okay. Executive actions, Senate Bill 145, Senate Resolution 12. That was Judge Brown from yesterday. And then Senate Resolutions 48 and 49 that we'll hear this morning.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, we'll begin the hearing on Senate Resolution 49 first. Senator Regeer, will you open on the resolution, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Keith Regeer, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, Senator from Senate District 3. I bring to the committee Senate Resolution 49, which is the appointees to the Public Safety Officer Standards and Training Council, usually referred to as POST. Those appointed, Leo Dutton, he is a Sheriff Coroner of Lewis and Clark County. Connor Smith, he's captain of a Montana Highway Patrol. Bill Smith, a retired military. Jesse Slaughter, Cascade County Sheriff. Jim Thomas, he had a career in law enforcement. And Kimberly Burdick, she's manager of the Choteau County Sheriff's Office. And committee, you have a resume for all of them. I will not go into that with you, but I'll let you listen to the proponents and opponents.
Okay, let's begin with proponents in the room today on Senate Resolution 49.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I should say Mr. Vice Chair. Leanne, for the record, Leanne, L-I-A-N-E, Taylor, Governor Gianforte's Boards and Appointments Advisor. Just a little about what the Post Council does. They set the employment and training standards for all public safety officers, and they provide for the certification or recertification of public safety officers, and also the suspension or revocation of certification. They have 13 members who serve four-year terms. And these members, many of them are reappointments. They have very specific requirements. Governor Gianforte's advisory team vetted all of these appointees, and we would ask your support in confirming them. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Jesse Slaughter, S-L-A-U-G-H-T-E-R, and I am the Cascade County Sheriff. And I would ask that you confirm my appointment to the Post Council. A little background and history on me. Prior to being elected sheriff, I served with both the Stillwater County Sheriff's Office and the Great Falls Police Department. I ran the training division there at the Great Falls Police Department for several years, during which time I was appointed by former Governor Bullock to the Post Council as a member of the MPPA. During that time, I served a little under 6 years on the council, so I'm very familiar with the council. I was actually there through the selection of the current executive director, Perry Johnson. Sat on many hearings, many different cases, also approved many different trainings, changed the ARMs that are now current and moving forward, served with many of the members who are currently appointed or going to be reappointed. And I'm excited about this opportunity to serve the state of Montana in this capacity. I feel this is a very, very important council, especially given some of the discourse about law enforcement in 2020. It is important that this council has the highest integrity and holds the highest standards for our law enforcement throughout the state. It is a huge honor for Governor Gianforte to appoint me to this council. I am humbled and I am honored, and I just ask that you confirm my appointment, and I'll be here for questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheriff Slaughter. Further proponents?
Good morning. I'm Captain Connor Smith, C-O-N-N-E-R-S-M-I-T-H. And I'm just here to thank you for the appointment. I know it was the governor that did that, but I appreciate you hearing me. I'll give you a little background about myself. So I've been in the Highway Patrol now for almost 17 years. Prior to that, served 6 years in the U.S. Navy. As far as the training background goes, I've done a lot of that. So I've been involved in training for the Highway Patrol for the past 14 years. Ran our training department as our training sergeant for 7 prior to this appointment to my captain position with the professional standards. So my position here now is, with the Highway Patrol, is I deal with internal affairs, serious uses of force, basically all of those critical incidents. And I'm also still in charge of all of our training that takes place both for Highway Patrol cadets at the academy and for in-service training. So broad background in training, been working with the academy for numerous years. I've worked with Perry for many years as the training representative for the Highway Patrol. A couple of things that are near and dear to my heart. Number one is constitutionally based policing. So I know the sheriff touched on the stuff that's going on in our nation, and the way I look at it, if the law enforcement knows the Constitution, follows the Constitution, keeps us out of trouble. So that's one of the big things that I push for all of our training, is to make sure that they actually know and understand the rights that all Montanans and American citizens have, and value those rights. So again, I thank you for hearing me here, and if there's any questions for me, I will be here.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Sure. Further proponents in the room?
Good morning, Vice Chair McGillivray and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Nanette Gilbertson, G-I-L-B-E-R-T-S-O-N, and I represent the Montana County Attorneys Association and the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, both organizations here to support the nominees for the post council. You've heard a little bit about the post council. From the law enforcement and sheriff perspective, it is critical for their profession. And I think every profession probably feels that way about the board, which is responsible for their licensure, and in this case, for the certification and or decertification of law enforcement officers. But it's more than just a council or board for law enforcement. The post council really acts as a moral compass for law enforcement in the state of Montana, and officers put great value in who sits on that council to ensure that they are held accountable. I don't know all of the nominees, but I do know 2 of them, and I'd like to speak on their behalf briefly. Sheriff Leo Dutton and Sheriff Jesse Slaughter would both make great members of the post council. Sheriff Dutton, is a current member, and as you heard, Sheriff Slaughter has served before. Leo is a dedicated public servant. He has worked for Lewis and Clark County for his entire career, but he is not just dedicated to the people of Lewis and Clark County. He is dedicated to the citizens in the state of Montana, and he has tried to extend his public service beyond the confines of this county and serve on boards and councils to provide that service to the state. He's also dedicated to integrity and the integrity of the profession of law enforcement, and that is the kind of person we want serving on the post council. Sheriff Slaughter, we've heard the phrase, I think, in the past couple months, change agent, and Sheriff Slaughter is indeed a change agent. He does not prescribe to the mentality of but we've always done it that way. He is open and willing to look at doing things different, doing things to adapt to changing circumstances, and I have a lot of faith in him to be a member of the Post Council and look at the totality of the situation and be a great change agent. Additionally, he has deep and firm beliefs rooted in responsibility and accountability, and he will help to ensure that the council and all members of the law enforcement profession in Montana are responsible and accountable to the oath that they take, their professional standards, and the Constitution of the United States and of Montana. I think all the members who are up for confirmation will serve the state of Montana well, and I would ask you to please pass forward the names. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents for SR 49 in the room? Seeing none, let's go to online proponents. Can we have Corey Swanson?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I am Corey Swanson. I'm the Broadwater County Attorney. I had the honor of serving on the advisory council in Governor Gianforte's transition team. And so myself and another group of people worked to look at all the people who had applied for the various positions. We were doing Director of Department of Corrections, Post Council, Board of Crime Control, and Board of Pardons and Parole. We were really impressed with the highly qualified people that applied, or in some cases even were recruited to apply for the various councils and positions. And we, as an organization, and it was an organization with experience as there was another county attorney, Scott Twidell from Yellowstone County. There were a couple of county commissioners. There were a couple of former sheriffs. There were people with a broad array of experience in the Department of Corrections, law enforcement, and the courts. We were really impressed with the applicants, and we strongly support, as a group, the list of names that you have here before you. I know several of them as well, went through all their qualifications in great detail. So would urge you to support this group of appointees for the Post Council. And I don't want to repeat too much of what was said already, but law enforcement is a very complicated endeavor and profession in today's environment. It's very difficult. It's amazing how many times when people have an emergency of any kind, first thing that they do is they call 911 and a law enforcement officer comes. And they may be coming to a fire, a mentally ill person who's in crisis, a crime, a crash. It could be any variety of things. And law enforcement officers have to arrive on scene, deal with the unexpected. They have to do so professionally. They have to do so with competence. They have to do so and respect the rights of individuals that they work with. So the Post Council has a very difficult job because it has to not only ensure that the organization is upholding those highest standards, but it occasionally has to deal with members who did not uphold those highest standards. So when we put people on the Post Council as a state of Montana, we want people who have the experience and the integrity to make those decisions. And frankly, that comes with probably a dose of humility, because I suspect if you were to ask each of these people at some point when they were a young officer or a rookie, they may have made a mistake, and that's actually a very good thing. Learning from those mistakes makes you a better leader and a better evaluator of other performance. So I have the greatest confidence. I speak on behalf of our entire group who was on the transition committee for Governor Gianforte, and as you've already heard, on behalf of the County Attorneys Association, we urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. And do we have Bill Smith online? Go ahead.
Good morning, Vice Chairman McGilvery, the other members in the room. Bill Smith, Flathead County, BILLSMITH. I'm Assistant Chief Detention Officer currently with the Flathead County Sheriff's Office. Been with the office for 22 and a half years. I do have some military experience, although I separated from military only after 4 years, so I'm not sure where the representation that I'm retired military came from, but I think it's critical that we have a detention officer with applicable level of experience on the board. I think I'm qualified for that position. I'm honored to be considered for appointment and committed, as the other members have said, to the integrity of our profession, the level of training our officers are provided, and the service that we provide to this community.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Do we have any further proponents or candidates online?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Do we have any opponents for SR 49 in the room? Seeing none. Any online? Seeing none. Questions from the committee or informational witnesses? Not online. Okay, let's go to questions for the committee. Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Corey Swanson, please.
Go ahead.
I'm here.
Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Swanson, it was interesting to hear that you were on the screening committee looking at applications for these positions. And these candidates clearly have lots of great qualifications. I wanted to know if you were aware that there's a state law that requires in all of these appointments of the governor to boards and commissions that those appointments reflect the gender balance of the state and racial parity where it is involved. And particularly in this case, when we're dealing with appointment to post and issues certainly of the disproportionate number of Native Americans that are in our correction system, and the importance of addressing that and trying to understand the factors that go into that. Were you aware of that law and in terms of recruitment and the diversity of people who might have applied for this board, how did you factor that in? Was that part of your discussion?
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Sands, I actually was not aware of that law, but I can tell you from looking at the applicants that actually applied. Well, one of them, for example, Kimberly Burdick, who is female, was reappointed. I'm not aware of any. I believe Jess Edwards, who is a tribal law enforcement officer and is a tribal member, his term did not expire, so he remains on post. I guess I don't know that there was any change that would have come about in terms of our recommendations for appointments, because I didn't see a whole lot of applicants who would have been specifically, if we were trying to fill a certain demographic. There was one person who applied who I think didn't meet quite all the qualifications of some of the other officers or applicants, wasn't currently in a law enforcement field. But beyond that, I think we took the best qualified we could find. I felt that there was some diversity among the applicants. We took into the fact that there were into account the fact that there was at least one tribal law enforcement officer currently on post that would remain on post. And I don't know that we had any kind of a specific percentage or quota that we were looking for. What I was looking for, I think, and I think we did discuss this, is folks who had some experience in detention. I think you just heard from one of the applicants. We felt that was important. That geographic balance, large agencies and small agencies, because they have different challenges. We have a highway patrol member. So I think we were looking at the breadth of experience that we have in law enforcement in Montana. And I think that there's a recognition specifically because there's a current position on post for a tribal law enforcement officer. There certainly could have been another one that we could have filled, but I don't think we had any tribal law enforcement officers apply that I can recall. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you. May I redirect to Ms. Taylor, please?
Yes, Senator Sands. Ms. Taylor?
Ms. Taylor, I don't know if you're aware of this law. It's been in place since, I think, about 86. And governors have made quite a bit of attempt to recruit people to reflect more of the diversity of the state of Montana. It's not a quota system. It doesn't reserve specific seats. It just says that appointments will be more reflective of the population as a whole, among other factors. And frequently over the years, that has meant going out and recruiting people to make sure that some of that diversity is reflected on boards and commissions, because initially it was so many things were, well, Native Americans weren't on hardly any of them, or other people of color, but specifically there were so many boards on which women didn't appear, and so many other boards on which, having to do with children, very few men appeared. So over the years, I think this has reflected more diversity, but can you tell me how you have gone about trying to conform with that statute? It is in law, and terms of trying to bring that kind of diversity to, say, this position and these other appointments?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Sands, yes, we are aware of that. There is a diversity report that the boards and...
Ms. Taylor, could you just speak right into that mic, please, for us?
Sure.
Thank you.
I apologize. There is a diversity report that has to go out. We are very aware of, you know, females, tribal members. In fact, there are some requirements on many of the boards for tribal members specifically. Obviously, if there's other, you know, I guess, racial groups that apply. In this particular one, the qualifications are very specific. Say the detention center. There were absolutely no females that had applied or that fulfilled that qualification. So, you know, on some of these boards, they're just the representative group doesn't necessarily have a lot of females or maybe tribal members. Does that answer your question?
It's a start. I just wanted to make sure you're well aware of the needs for that, and that, you know, particularly when it comes to these in the criminal justice system, given we have such a highly disproportionate number of Native Americans, it becomes an issue, and actually a hugely rising number of women who are coming into the correction system. So thank you. I appreciate your comment.
Thank you.
Thank you. The question, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I would like to have a question for Captain Smith, please, of the Montana Highway Patrol.
Yes, I'm here. What's your question, please?
Mr. Vice Chair, Captain Smith, let's see, there's always been issues in Indian country regarding racial profiling. And it's been an ongoing question. It's always been behind there. What are your thoughts about dispelling those questions on racial profiling in Montana? Or on the Highway Patrol, I guess.
Okay, yes, thank you for the question. So the Highway Patrol has been tracking everybody we stop, their racial profile, since I've been on, since before that. And so we keep all that data to ensure that we are acting fairly and honestly. If we get any complaints regarding any racial issues, it's always investigated by our HR department. Could also be, if there's any serious allegations, investigated by my department now. We have not had any issues with that I'm aware of since I've been in this position. And we in our training platform, we do take it very seriously on how we instruct our officers as far as enforcing those codes. So we can't just go and stop random vehicles. There always has to be probable cause. And I spoke about constitutionality of how we enforce those laws. We take that very seriously. And so we as a department value all citizens, but we value the law and we follow that. And if anybody is out of line, if it ever comes to our attention, then we actually do address those on a case-by-case basis.
Does follow that answer up, what? Mr. Vice Chair.
Go ahead.
In your training, do you have cultural, like a cultural sensitivity course or embedded in your training program?
Well, we have ethics courses. I'm not sure if we have anything that's specifically called cultural diversity, but we do have, we actually have an outreach position, which we have a captain in the patrol who's directed to work with all the reservations on the state, and he works very closely with all of them. You know, we have all of our trainings, which are mandated by post and by the state, at, you know, curriculums, I guess, which we follow, and we go above and beyond all the required trainings. We value that. So I'm not sure about specifically to that name of that class, but we do have ethics classes which cover that type of background.
Follow up, Mr. Vice Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Weber.
In regards to MMIW or MMIP, what role does the Montana Highway Patrol play in that policy in finding these people? On reservations, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with MMIP.
Murdered and missing Indigenous women or people.
Okay, so I'm not the expert as far as that goes on, for the Highway Patrol on that. Like I said, we do have the captain of the patrol. His name is Derek Warner. He is working with all the reservations. He actually lives in Poplar, and he is in charge of our District 8. And he has been working directly with all the reservations, specifically on that case, on those instances. But that's not my expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Captain Smith. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and members of the public, just so you know, that computer up there and the camera on it is actually what the senators on Zoom can see, and the audio picks up better if you face forward. So for anybody further testifying, just keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Chair. This would be toward either Officer Dutton or Smith, since you both were on the group prior, if you guys want to answer those questions. Can you give me a start to finish on what it takes or what the time frame is to complete a post-training for an officer? Oh, sorry. Slaughter. Apologize. Wrote it down wrong.
All right, so this is Captain Smith again. So as far as to get a basic post-certificate?
Yes.
Okay, so everybody has to go through the 12-week Montana Law Enforcement Academy. Once they complete that, they have to complete successfully their one-year probation. And from that point, basically they get their basic post-certificate. We in the Highway Patrol, we send our guys through an additional 11-week training academy in addition to the basic law enforcement academy.
Follow-up, Chair.
Go ahead.
The reason I asked that question is because one of the issues that needed to be addressed is back in Billings, we had a significant backlog of trying to get officers post-certified. And could you address the reasons for the backlog?
So I know that there's space limitations to our law enforcement academy. They've increased class size, and they're basically pushing to the limit every class that they can do. And there's just not enough room to facilitate more classes. Under Montana code, you can be hired on and then still not even attend the academy for a full year. So, you know, there's that going on, and there's this constant backlog of people trying to get into the academy. So it's a fight for slots.
I definitely have heard that every year when I was on the council. Follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Now that you're on this board, now that you may be reassigned to this board, what solutions are you going to bring to remedy the current issue? Is there something we can do? Is there something you guys can do? I mean, what is your remedy for this problem? Because I can tell you right now, we're backlogged, and Billings so bad that we have several, I think last time I checked, like over 10 officers waiting for post-training.
Well, it's going to involve funding and money, of course, to expand the law enforcement academy. When their max class size is, say, 60 cadets or recruits, that creates its own limitations, and it's hard to go around that. Now, the academy is growing, so I think that class size, and Administrator Glenn Steiner probably could answer that better for you, but they are increasing the classroom space. They're revamping the housing facilities. So I believe that that's going to increase the class size to better allow for that. And that's short of doing, other than that, there's really not a lot that can be done as far as speeding up the process. You know, we can't shorten the classes. It's already, that 12 weeks is a minimum. Like I said, we add in our own training in addition to that. Most officers don't get that. So to shorten it is just not feasible. So the best is expanding, which they're in the process of doing.
I would agree. I would not want to shorten their education because it's a very important position, believe me. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Slaughter. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Slaughter, just kind of throw an easy softball question to you just so we can hear from you a little bit. And I ask this because it seems to be occupying a lot of my time lately, but we've got I-190 legalizing, adult use marijuana. What is Post doing, or what do you think our needs are there, and do you see anything that perhaps we need to take care of legislatively work within that new law?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Brown, thank you for the question. I think that's an outstanding question. Recreational marijuana was the vote of the people. As a constitutional sheriff, I deeply respect that. However, there could be some unintended consequences because of the recreational marijuana becoming legal. So I think one of the things looking forward in Post that we're probably going to have to consider is how do we deal with our law enforcement officers, our public safety officers throughout the state of Montana with regards to this law. I can tell you right now, as a sheriff, I'm working with our Human Resources Department in Cascade County trying to determine proper policy for my deputies. You know, essentially, when marijuana becomes recreational, the key word is recreationally legal, it's by proxy like alcohol. However, as Captain Smith can probably articulate, because he's probably far more experienced in the realm of DUI and drug, basically seeing what type of drugs people have on board, one of the things we have to consider is marijuana is going to act differently. Typically, when people consume alcohol, if they go to bed, they sleep for 8 hours, and they wake up in the morning, as long as it's not overly excessive, they're not going to have that in their system when they go to work. However, marijuana is a different drug, and it could be possible that your employee could be driving a high-speed automobile and carrying a gun with that in their system still. And that's a great concern. So it could be a challenge that comes before the Post Council due to the fact that somebody's involved in an incident, a law enforcement officer, a peace officer, a detention officer, a probation officer, what have you, and they have marijuana on board when it occurs. We're going to have to address those issues, and hopefully through legislation and proper policy, we can do what I call as anticipatory leadership and have good policy before those issues become issues, because I think that's going to be key as leaders. We're going to need to do that. So I think that could be a tremendous challenge as it affects peace officers throughout the state of Montana. Great question.
Thank you.
Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, also for Sheriff Slaughter. Mr. Vice Chair, Sheriff Slaughter, I really appreciate your detailed resume and follow-up questions. And so I'm looking at all the training that you've received over the years, and it's 2,900 total hours of law enforcement training. I'm no expert, but that seems like a pretty impressive number. Can you just clarify for me, those are hours that you have been trained, not hours that you've have spent training other officers?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross, I believe what's on my resume are my actual hours, which I received in training.
Thank you. And I've got a couple of follow-ups.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Sheriff Slaughter, you mentioned in your testimony that you spent 7 years training at the Great Falls Police Department. And I also see on your resume you've highlighted relationship building, which is so important. I think we as legislators really understand that, and in working with stakeholders, it's crucial. So I'm curious, how have you, during your time at the Post Council, which I'm assuming you've, during as a post member, that's been during your time as a sheriff, correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross, no, that was during my previous time, was when I was a Great Falls police officer.
Okay, excellent. Mr. Chair and Sheriff Slaughter, how during that time, how did you work to build relationships with the local police department and other state agencies, maybe the Cascade County Sheriff's Department?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross, a lot. That is the component of all leadership that I think we often fail at, is collaboration and communication, and it's key. And as I relate this to the Post Council, I have the very unfortunate task of replacing Sheriff Harbaugh on this board, and those are big shoes to fill, literally. And I will tell you that one of the lessons I learned from Sheriff Harbaugh when I served with him on the council was I would have solutions to problems that fit my organization, but they did not fit Custer County Sheriff's Office. They did not fit the Montana Highway Patrol. They did not fit corrections. And that is the hardest part about being on a council like this, is you have to consider that lawmakers, commissioners, both county and city, they have limited budgets in which to operate on. I will tell you that I believe in training. I believe in training is risk management. And if we are going to have the best law enforcement in America, which I believe we have in Montana, but if we're going to continue that tradition, we have to train our people. Okay. It's simple. It's predictable. If we train our people, we'll have good outcomes. But it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, because not everybody has the budget. So one of the important things that I think moving forward, and I was talking to Executive Director Perry Johnson about this just last week, we have to educate the public about what POST does, and we have to involve other agencies to train the trainer and help our smaller organizations that have less budgets throughout the state. I'm a big believer in that. I went and saw the 10 surrounding sheriffs that surround me, with the exception of Lewis and Clark, because they're of similar size. And I went to them and I offered them my help. What do you need? Do you need training? Do you need help? Do you need this? Because I think that's a critical component of that collaboration that we're talking about. The other thing I think is key moving forward that I think we need to be anticipating and important, law enforcement is painted with the same brush regardless. Okay? I mean, I can't tell you how many times my deputies are referred to as police officers, so on and so forth. The public doesn't care. When they call 911, they want help, you know? And the important thing I think we need to understand is we also do need to have, we need to govern to our own communities, right? Montana has different communities, has different size communities. It has different expectations of what their law enforcement should do for each community. For example, Senator Gross, you're from Billings. That's a vastly different community than, let's say, Shoto, Montana. And they're going to be, they'll use the broad term, policed differently, so to speak. However, I think one of the important things that we need to look forward in the future of POST is we need to have some consistency throughout the state, just so people understand what the expectation law enforcement's going to do. And then we also have to do a good job, and this is one of the things that I'm excited about doing for POST that I want to do, of creating a media presence in which educates the public about what law enforcement's going to do and how they're going to respond to given situations. It also will create accountability for us, because that once that information is out there, we're then accountable to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I hope it's just one last follow-up. Thank you, Sheriff Slaughter. You're right. The collaboration piece is so important, and so is figuring out how to make things work in, you know, a state that's so diverse in terms of our communities. So you mentioned train the trainer, and I like that. And now I'm going to try to be sensitive here, because you also mentioned in your opening statement, you know, that we need to be aware of some of the rhetoric around law enforcement in 2020, particularly. So, and I'm really glad to hear you're committed to training. So I do notice, like, you know, you've given us a list of all of the training you've received over the years. The last one was in 2000 for grant writing, and some of the training goes back decades. So I know that, you know, trainings or standards for officers have changed a lot over the decades. And so, no, maybe there's not a question there, but it sounds like you're committed to, you know, train the trainer and, you know, continuing that training for yourself. So I'll move on to my last question, which is, so in June 2020, the Missoulian reported about this issue of potential excessive use of force where a woman's arm was broken. And I believe it involved a probation and parole officer with the local police department. And I know you've been with the sheriff's department since then. But, and then, you know, that case, there was evidence that disappeared, and that was never elevated to the level of post. So can you talk about how something like that, an issue which I would assume would, you know, get elevated up to the post council to take a look at. Can you talk about how a local police department would elevate such a matter to the post council, and how, as a post council member, you would work to maybe assist a local law enforcement agency when something like that happens? And let's just use the excessive use of force. And that was never proven, you know, it was dropped, but let's just use that as an example and talk about how POST will work with other agencies to address these issues that are of serious concern.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross, thank you for the question. First, I want to know, I don't think you're looking at my resume if it doesn't have training after 2000. I started in law enforcement in 2000, so I'm not sure if that's correct on that, just as a point of clarification. To your question, Senator Gross, I think it's a great question. I think it's super important. Again, I'm going to go back to one of my goals is POST needs to get more active in the education and public education of what POST's role is. There are a lot of people that believe a lot of things about POST and what's POST's role that aren't simply true. They're not true, and that's not what they do. So we need to do a good job of educating them. To your question of excessive use of force and reporting, yes, that can be an issue. Law enforcement has to not only report things when they terminate people to post, but even if people retire, but they retire under an investigation, that needs to be noted, and that needs to be reported to post. And it's an integrity issue, and that's one of POST jobs, making sure they're educating people. There are people that make an honest mistake, don't understand the rules of POST, they didn't read the ARMs, they don't, you know, whatever. But that's our job as POST, to educate people. That's part of it. With regards to excessive use of force, I can tell you we took this issue so seriously at the Cascade County Sheriff's Office that we started a use of force committee. And it is made up of a Native American female, an African American male, and a female defense attorney. We even put a defense attorney on there to make sure we were accountable. And they review once a month every single use of force the Cascade County Sheriff's Office puts on. Every video recording, every single report, you name it, they review it. They sit with our county attorney and our undersheriff, and they're an advisory board. And they make advisory decisions about how we're going to conduct our use of force in the future if we did it correct. We also understood, and I kind of want to tailor this question to Senator Sands' question about diversity. I believe it was Senator Sands, about diversity as it relates. We also understand that use of force is viewed different through different lenses. We know that. We understand that. Us in law enforcement get tainted and jaded because we view it through our lens. But we don't view it through a citizen's end, a constitutionally free citizen who has force used on them by law enforcement. And we often forget that. And that's why we have such a diverse board that looks at those. And it was really encouraging. Most of our feedback was, oh, you need to use force faster. Why do you, you know, in our circumstances? But it was really interesting to see how they viewed the world and how they viewed the use of force. But that is accountability piece, and I've made it very public that that's what we're going to do. So I understand its importance. And in Post is that entity that we're ultimately accountable to when it comes to these issues. And I think one of the important things that people need to understand about Post's role is Post has the basically license over your certificates. So once you go to the academy, you get a basic certificate. As you move forward, you get intermediate. You may get training certificates to train, all sorts of different types of certificates. If we have a bad actor in law enforcement, we have a person who is not holding not only their oath, that's only one part. We all read, and it's part of Post rules, we all read, all of our sworn and peace officers, a code of ethics. An ethical violation will get you fired. An ethical violation will get you decertified. And we do all that, and then we're ultimately accountable to Post. And the reason I think that's important is this. Everyone in here, everyone that's a lawmaker knows and understands this. The rules of employment, hiring, and firing are different than laws and ethics. They're vastly different, and they are very subjective. They also are confidential. Everybody understands that whether you terminate someone for cause or whatnot, that is usually confidential information through your human resources department. However, your training certificates and stuff belong to Post. And so Post then gets is obligated to get to review those records and then decide if you can have a certificate or not. So it's a safeguard for when you run into, say, a HR decision that doesn't allow you to terminate an employee for being a quote-unquote bad actor. And so it's kind of a secondary fallback. And I think that's a critical piece of information that people need to understand.
Sure. And one more, Mr. Chair, follow-up. And thank you for educating me. I didn't know about the excessive use of force advisory board in Cascade County. I think that's pretty cool. And could you just talk about how are those board, so you say they review every report of use of force, they look at body cam. I didn't know y'all were using body cams. That's great. How are they, how is that a closed process? Does the public have access to any of that information? And then follow-up question on that, how does this advisory board interface with Post?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross, just as a point of clarification, we don't have body cameras. When I say cameras, our car cameras, and then our entire jail facility is under camera. So there's always tons of footage. With regards to how the advisory board works is they could have, they sign a confidentiality agreement because they're given criminal justice information. So they do not have the right to share it with the public unless our county attorney, who is also a member of the board, signs off on that. And then he would then allow them to speak to the public about that. You know, that what our goal here is we're trying to create ambassadors. I'll be completely transparent. We're trying to create ambassadors to law enforcement that can go out and tell the public what our heart is, what our real intent in doing our job is. It gets lost in mainstream media about what law enforcement's intent is. Everybody gets into this career and profession to do the right thing, you know, but people are imperfect. People make mistakes. And it's important when they make those mistakes, we're transparent, honest about it. And you tend to have a better chance of moving on from those mistakes when you are. And this is an accountability piece for us. But to answer your question, unless it was something that deemed the county attorney deemed they could then talk to the public about, then they would. My goal would be that if we ever had a critical use of force incident that went massively public, and it was already out there, we could have people speak to our history, speak to what our policies are. They get all of our policies, all that stuff. So they could speak to how we conducted each of those use of force under those policies.
I appreciate that. And sorry, this, I promise, is the last piece. But how does the advisory board interface with Post? And if it doesn't, will you work? Is that something you will work on at Post?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Gross. So it would interface with POST. I would guess it would through their, I just forgot the name of the committee that sanctions the certificate. Sorry, just left me. If we were to have an unlawful use of force and the board deemed that, and then we took action upon that employee, those individuals would likely be witnesses to that action, because anybody who sees it would then likely be a witness to that. But again, we just have to be, there's always this delicate line between employment rights and public information, but that's why the county attorney sits on the board, because he's the one that can make that decision.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Not? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber has her hand raised.
Go ahead, Senator Weber. Just reminding the committee we have three other bills today. Let's move along. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. For Sheriff Slaughter, please.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Weber.
Mr. Vice Chair and Sheriff Slaughter. You were talking about bad actors. Does POST track the bad actors? Like if some officer is disciplined in one area or in one county and they move to another county, does POST do that? Do they track those so that other police departments know that there's issues with that officer?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Weber, that is the intent, yes. If a law enforcement officer is sanctioned or decertified, that is the absolute intent of POST. So what will happen then is the agency that then would attempt to hire that individual would not be able to bring them on board because they would have lost their certification. However, it does require that each agency is fully disclosing the individual's actions when they left that agency. So that's the integrity of the agency who reported to POST upon termination of that employee would have to make a report so that POST was then aware of it. Once POST is aware of it, yes, there is a record of that, and it does, that is the exact intent of POST, is so that a quote-unquote bad actor who is in law enforcement not doing things under the Constitution and ethics that our state has created, they don't go on to work for another organization and become that community's issue.
Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Does that apply to tribal police departments? Does a tribal police department, are they able to get that information? And vice versa, like if there is a officer sanctioned by the tribal police department and goes to Great Falls?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Weber, yes, if it is a police department. If it was a federal law enforcement entity, no. But if it was a local police department that attended Montana Law Enforcement Academy, yes, that would apply.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Right. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, Senator Bennett, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Captain Smith. Mr. Chair and Captain Smith, I heard both you and Sheriff Slaughter talk about being constitutional, doing constitutional enforcement, and outside of just what I assume means you follow the Constitution, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis, and does that differ from other policing types?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. That is a very good question. So in my mind, what it means, all of our authority as police officers comes from the citizens we serve. If officers don't understand that, then they feel like they can take away people's rights, maybe a little easier. They don't think as long and hard as they should about arresting someone and taking away their freedom. So understanding the true sense of what our Constitution means and the freedom in which we enjoy, and how much that, how important that is to us, both from the founding fathers all the way up through our current day. Having that basic understanding makes the law make more sense. By understanding that we work for the people and that we get our authority from the people means that without the support of the people, we can't do our job, right? So what we try to stress in the Highway Patrol, and I know in the Law Enforcement Academy, throughout POST, we all try to stress that that's where we get our power from, our authority from, is from the people. And if we don't maintain that trust, we can't do our job. And it's been illustrated, you could see it in certain places like Baltimore as an example, when they were having some of the serious racial issues that were going on there. Police were making traffic stops and getting swarmed by the neighborhood. Obviously, you can't do that job. It's not practical. It's just impossible to do. We can't be an occupying force. There's not very many of us in this large state. We have to have the trust of the people. We have to have their support. And that's why I stress the Constitution so much, is because that's our basis for, well, everything as a country, that's our basis. And if we can understand the full meaning of it, then we honor that in how we enforce the law. And we take it much more seriously when we do, like I say, take away someone's freedom.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Regeer, would you like to close?
Mr. Chairman, before I close, could we have Ms. Taylor come up and explain a little misinformation in the packet?
Sure. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, regarding and Bill Smith that is on the Zoom, there was a mistake, and this is where the military aspect came in for William Smith. What you have in your packet is William Neal Smith. I have here enough copies of William Smith from Kalispell, the detention officer. So I can pass those out with your permission.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can see that they're highly qualified people for POST, and I hope the committee agrees. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Regeer. This closes the hearing on Senate Resolution 49. Senator Regeer, would you like to begin on Senate Resolution 48?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Keith Regeer, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, Senator from Senate District 3. I bring Senate Resolution 48. It's an appointment to the Board of Pardons and Parole, Mr. Steve Hurd, and it's a reappointment, and I will let him tell us about himself and listen to proponents, opponents, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Regeer. Mr. Hurd.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today. I'm a little naive to this process, so I apologize if I don't address you accordingly.
No worries.
Vice Chair, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Stephen Hurd. I come to the Board of Pardons from a long line of corrections experience. I started in 1985 as a client advisor with Alternatives Incorporated in Billings. Halfway through my college career, I went to the Yellowstone County Sheriff's Department, in which I worked in detention for 2 years and graduated and went to the work of probation and parole for 25 years. I spent a number of those years in a multi-agency drug task force and retired in 2014. I have been an investigator for the Department of Labor and Industry for the past 5.5 years, and I'm standing before you honored and humbled to be appointed by the governor to the Board of Pardons and Parole.
Thank you. Further proponents for Senate Resolution 48?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lieutenant Governor Kristen Juras, J-U-R-A-S, and on behalf of Governor Gianforte, we request your confirmation of Mr. Hurd to the Board of Pardons and Parole. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Further proponents? Seeing none in the room. We have Corey Swanson. Go ahead.
Morning, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. I'm trying to lower my hand here. I'm Corey Swanson. I'm the Broadwater County Attorney. As I mentioned in the last hearing, I was privileged to serve on one of the transition advisory groups for Governor Gianforte, and this group did consider multiple applicants for the position being on the Board of Pardons and Parole. We recommend Stephen Hurd with great enthusiasm. And I just want to briefly point out that this position is a little bit unique from some of the others in that this position becomes a full-time employee. And the Board of Pardons and Parole is a position of great responsibility because of the continual need to assess the effectiveness of Department of Corrections, rehabilitation and correctional policy, and then literally assess individual cases. And these are cases where people have been convicted of some felony crime, and they have to evaluate the person's, their performance, their record in the correctional facility, if they've had any training or treatment or rehabilitation or anything like that. If they've complied with the court's orders, they have input from victims often and from law enforcement and prosecutors and from family members. And so this is a position with a lot of responsibility. It requires a lot of good judgment and wisdom and experience. And we feel that Mr. Hurd has that experience. If you look at the resume there, you'll see there's a great deal of experience there, as well as, I think, a pretty good educational background for this position. So, again, on behalf of the advisory group and my peers in the County Attorneys Association, we urge your support for this appointment.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Further proponents? Seeing none, do we have any opponents in the room? Seeing none, any opponents online? Seeing none, any informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. For the nominee, Mr. Hurd, please.
Good morning. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
She'll ask the question. Go ahead. You can face forward, because when you're facing forward, she can see you.
Okay.
I can see you straight on. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Hurd, congratulations on your reappointment. I have a question for you as a current member as well of the Board of Pardons and Parole. You know, one of the continuing frustrations that we've looked at repeatedly in the Interim Committee on Law and Justice, and we hear from constituents across the state, is the frustration that we have so many offenders currently sitting in prison who are eligible for parole, but who sit in our institutions for months at a time at the taxpayers' expense when they're eligible, simply because there is not available programming in the communities for them to be participating in. Can you address, I mean, it's one of the bottlenecks we have in terms of reducing our prison population safely, is that access to community programming. Can you talk to me about your view on that and what the Board of Pardons and Parole should be doing to try to address that problem? Thank you.
Thank you. We look at the availability of programming for the offenders' needs. We do a number of risk assessments based on those offenders' needs, and we try to place them accordingly. And we look at a variety of sober living homes, pre-release centers. The halfway houses are imperative to getting our population back into the public and reintegrated back into society. So we take every opportunity we have to reintroduce those folks into the community, but we do so in a safe and very conscientious manner.
follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator Sands.
Mr. Chair, I understand that and I agree with that, but there has to be ways to create more programming in the community or to allow people to take courses, perhaps while they're still in prison, as a way to, since they are have been determined by your board to be eligible for parole, the barrier is simply that there is no place for them to go. There has got to be a better solution to that because, as you know, we are holding more people in our prison much higher than the national average, and we need to find a way to expedite getting offenders back into our community, back into jobs, back with their family, and provide for public safety at the same time. And right now, that is not adequate the way it is. So can you talk about what the plan is to go forward?
Well, we only have so many beds available in our communities as resources for placement, and there isn't always available programming for those people to undergo while they are incarcerated for a variety of reasons. So they only have the availability of that programming in the community. So that's kind of where the bottleneck occurs. Whereas if we could get these folks through the programming that they are so required to attend while institutionalized, they would be ready to come out to the community sooner, but we don't have that availability, obviously now due to COVID, due to the availability of staff trained to provide those services. And so we aren't able to get those folks through the programming while they're inside to make them more readily available to come out to the community.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hurd, I would hope that you and the rest of the board would take more leadership in advocating for the creation of those programs, because that is an ongoing frustration, I think, across the board. And I also want to commend you, members of the committee may not know, you're quite the hero in the Laurel community from your work in your previous role when you were a parole officer in helping to safely disarm a former parolee who was holding hostages. And I just want to know that I noticed that and I commend that, and I thank you for your service.
Well, I appreciate your research on the Joel Prescott incident. That was a tenuous incident in the city of Laurel. We were grateful for the happy ending, and those are relationships and rapports that I built with those people that were on supervision. And I think it's imperative that we recognize those field staff for doing that kind of work, because it's a team effort between us and law enforcement and the other agencies involved, especially in a hostage situation like that where there were four children and a senior citizen in the home. And it was a relationship I had built through honesty and trust with him, and it was a very peaceful ending, thank goodness.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Weber?
Vice Chair, for Mr. Hurd, please.
Go ahead.
Vice Chair, Mr. Hurd, how long, I'm new at this, but how long is the wait time when an inmate is granted parole after they're first eligible for parole? Is there a wait time?
How long is the wait time after they're granted parole?
When they're granted parole and then released, I guess.
Calculate their parole eligibility date?
Yes. Mr. Hurd, is there a wait time between when they're first eligible for parole and then when they're granted parole, I guess?
Well, there's a number of dynamics and variables involved in that calculation. It's based on program availability, their amenability to programming. Oftentimes, we have folks that are required to attend programming, but that have no interest in doing so. And so there's a lot of different variables involved in calculating that exact release time from their parole eligibility date. Some folks become parole eligible and never seek parole because parole is a privilege, not a right. You're being released to the community prior to the expiration of an incarcerated sentence. And so there's just so many different dynamics, it's hard to measure that.
Follow up, Mr. Vice Chair?
Go ahead.
You were talking about a program, and they have to complete a program. What is that? What does that consist of?
Well, there are a number of programs for the sex offenders. Some are court-ordered to complete sex offender 1-2 treatment prior to becoming parole eligible. Some folks are required to complete the intensive treatment unit. There are different treatment modules that they may be mandated to attend and complete prior to being eligible to be released from the prison.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Are there any like training programs or, you know, high set or anything while they're in this process?
You mean to motivate them to attend the treatment they're required?
Yes, as they're in incarcerated, is there any like to self-help things that other than the programming to allow them to be more successful out in the community?
Well, I think they work closely with their case managers, and there are institutional probation and parole officers that assist in trying to direct them towards a successful outcome of their incarceration, to reintegrate them to society, which is so imperative for us to reduce the numbers in the prison. And I think they get a lot of guidance, support, and direction, as well as encouragement from both the case manager and the institutional probation and parole officers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, Senator Gross?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for Mr. Hurd. Thanks for being here today. And I'm from Billings, Yellowstone County, so I recall the incident in Laurel. Now, you mentioned the role of halfway houses as being critical to helping folks get out into community programs. And I was trying to look for meeting minutes because I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I think within the past couple of weeks, we've heard about some issues with some halfway houses that are not regulated by the state. And I have a lot of those in my district. I'm in South Central Billings, and the South Side Triangle is in there, as well as probation and parole in my district. But can you talk a little bit, or do you have any comments on some of these halfway houses that are not regulated, and whether there's a way in your role and the Board of Probations and Parole, that you could work with some of these folks and to address some of those licensing issues so that we do have more resources and we can get folks out of institutions and back into communities?
Senator Gross, Vice Chair, that's a great question. I'd like to clarify a few things for you. I think what you're referring to is sober living homes, okay, and those are not considered halfway houses or pre-release centers. Under the definition of the Department of Corrections, there's only passages and Alpha House, both under the umbrella of Alternatives, yep, Incorporated. So what you're referring to is the sober living homes.
Okay.
And I don't know if they are governed specifically by anybody but in the state, but we do address placement in those proper homes. And we have some great success with those sober living homes because they're folks that are in recovery themselves, have a good understanding of recovery. Some of them have been in the system before and were successful in completing. And so they have a great motivation to help other folks achieve sobriety and compliance with their conditions of supervision. So I don't know that they're regulated by the state, though.
Mr. Chair, quick follow-up, but thank you for the clarification and correcting me because, I think you're right, or you are right. I just don't have all my terminology down sometimes. It is my understanding, based on testimony, I think that we heard last week, and because this issue has come up over with the Law and Justice Interim Committee over the last couple of interims, that they are not regulated by the state, and that is why often DOC will not release folks, even if there are open beds in some of these homes. What is your sort of philosophy on that? Because I think the argument is, there are beds, and some of these folks are credible. I've gone and knocked on their doors and talked to them, and I've actually joined them for meals. But on the other hand, we have corrections stating, that there needs to be some regulatory or oversight here, maybe licensing. And so I've heard that as sort of the the tension there. Do you have any comments on that or a philosophy on which direction we should go with that?
Senator Gross, Vice Chair, last week I queried a number of the field staff to see what their position was on the effectiveness of these homes. Generally, they're a 3 to 6 month placement. They are compensated for taking the inmate into the home. Surprisingly enough, in the Billings area, there's 7 or 8 of those homes, and I really only garnered feedback negatively from one of them. So we don't hesitate to place them if these folks are willing to go to those settings. The problem that we're having is, we get folks in those placements, and sometimes they stay 3 or 4 days and then want to go elsewhere. So it kind of defeats the purpose of them being in that environment to assist them in their sobriety and their recovery process.
Sure. And Mr. Chair, if I could just make a comment. Thank you. Mr. Hurd, I appreciate that. And it seems like, you know, maybe that is where the issue is because, some of these guys are released directly into the community. They're not under supervision. And maybe I need more clarification there. We don't have to cover it now. But I can see why DOC would want, some licensing, some oversight, or some regulation because, maybe it's not a good thing to just have someone walk away after 3 or 4 days. So that was my comment. And feel free to follow up if you want.
But. Well, I'd just like to let you know that we, with a very... we're very discerning in who we want to release to the community for a variety of reasons. We don't want to further impact the citizens of our community by further victimization, so we do take a very concerned approach to those releases, especially when we're getting repetitive folks that are released to a 3-month or 6-month placement in one of these places, and then we have them only stay 3 to 6 days or a month, and then they're gone. And they do have supervision, Senator. They do have the parole officer in that community that oversees their supervision. So they do have a good relationship with those homes, the parole officers do. Sometimes they notify us when they leave. Sometimes they don't.
Thank you. Thank you for
Thank you.
The time.
Any questions, Senator Rydell?
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning. Question, does your board have any authority over where parolees are sent to in the state?
You know, we look at a number of different, Senator Fredell, Vice Chair, we do have a number of different placements we look at. We try to place them accordingly that's most conducive to what we feel is going to be a great environment for their recovery and their success. So, yes, we do look at a number of options for placement.
Follow-up question, Chairman. Can you explain to me why in the last year, if I remember correctly, the numbers was about 260 parolees were released, and of which all but I think 7 of them were sent to Billings, Montana. Is there a particular reason why we have a disparity of parolees being introduced into my community and not getting the services provided?
Senator Fragile, Vice Chair, the enormity of availability of beds in Billings, when you have 2 pre-release centers of our size, we do get a number of those placements comparative to Helena. Missoula has a larger facility, but Billings has a vast amount of beds. And I think that the availability of work prior to COVID was such that folks want to come to Billings because we're a service-driven city and folks can get employment quite readily there. And as you well know, a lot of those folks stay in our community. So,
follow-up question.
Go ahead.
So you're telling me that I know we have the facilities, but yet you're telling me the rest of the state does not have the same facilities or have the same capability of providing jobs like Billings does and other places like Missoula, Kalispell, and such?
I think they do, Senator. I think they have availability. I just think that there's... some folks are enamored to come to the big city and try to start a new life. Folks want to try to find a geographical cure to what may have sent them to prison in the past, and I think sometimes they seek to come to that city because they hear from other folks the successes that they've had there, both with treatment, with pre-release with the parole staff, and I just think that they're enamored to come there for that reason.
A follow-up question, Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you for speaking in regards to the facilities. I don't know if you're aware of this. In the last handful of years, we had a significant amount of people walk away from these private organizations, in which I believe in 2018, one of them actually went to our Heights area and actually murdered somebody. What is your thoughts and feelings in regards to the two facilities that are privately owned that are housing these parolees, as opposed to maybe a state-run organization handling these, such as DOC, as opposed to a private organization?
Senator Friedel, Vice Chair, I'd like to think there was some great answer to that question. I don't think you're going to see anything different from a state-owned facility as from a private-run facility, because we're dealing with humanity. And accountability is going to be the same, nevertheless, which the institution is run by the state, owned by the state, or run by private industry, as these are. We put these folks out in the community. There really isn't any way to chain them to where they're supposed to be 24/7. You know, they're responsible to their agenda. They're responsible to their employer. We have a number of folks that across the state choose not to return to that facility and end up on escape status. And I'd like to think that we could control humanity to the nth degree, but unfortunately we can't.
Follow-up, Chairman.
Go ahead.
Are you aware of a device called a GPS device that can actually show you where these parolees are at any given time 24/7?
Yes, sir.
And do you not think that that might be a better idea, maybe putting them on GPS as opposed to putting them in, say, one of those facilities, and maybe give them the option of, instead of having to be at these facilities, maybe actually integrate them into maybe housing and things like that in that regards, but also using technology to keep track of these parolees?
Well, I think that those electronic devices are a necessary entity for pretrial services and are certainly available to the staff, you know, through our intensive supervision program. We have high-risk offenders that the Probation and Parole Department does electronic monitoring on, and I know there are a number of different available programs out there that offer those devices. You know as well as I do how many times those devices are compromised and cut off and thrown away. And so I'd like to think that we have some great success with those, but only to the degree that the person wearing them retains them.
Follow-up question.
Go ahead.
But with those technologies, we would know immediately if this person was going to either reoffend, abscond, or anything like that, as opposed to right now, we have situations that we wait until 3 o'clock in the morning before somebody's actually notified that they're missing. And that's kind of one of the issues I have, but maybe that's more of a statement than a question. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hurd, you know, we've heard a lot about releasing people and programs and everything else. I'd just like you to speak a little bit about, victims' rights and how that weighs in your decision-making.
You know, we have a victims' advocate that works with our board on a full-time basis, and she has close communication with all the victims. We allow victims to both interact in the hearing process as well as communicate with the board one-on-one or in writing. We think it's imperative that we protect our victims from further victimization, and so that's why we have a full-time staff member that does just that.
So then just short follow-up.
Go ahead.
So then, you know, as we're going through this parole process, which I'm completely unfamiliar with, to be honest. I mean, in the questioning and as you're interviewing the parolee, I mean, are there questions that you ask to assure that those victims are going to be safe? I don't know how this process really works.
Well, I'd like to think that we could predict human behavior, Senator, but I don't think that that's possible. We do go over a list of risk and needs evaluations. We also interview the offender to see what it is that they've gained from the programming that they've taken advantage of, both in the institution and any other placement that they've had. you know, you get a good feeling for these folks when you interview them, how interested they are in living a crime-free lifestyle, as well as making retribution to the victims. A lot of times there's a monetary component tied to that crime as well. So we try to ensure that those folks try to make the victim as whole as possible, whether it's from a fiscal sense or an emotional sense. And sometimes they do take a participative role in the perpetrator's process. And we wholeheartedly accept all of their comments and give them great consideration during this process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, the sponsor would like to close.
I think it's evident that Mr. Hurd has the experience and the knowledge to do the job, and I just hope the committee will do pass on Senate Resolution 48, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Resolution 48.
Committee, I don't see Senator Howard in the room, so we'll try to get a hold of him.
Hi, I was looking for Senator Howard. This is home phone. We're just looking for him in the Judiciary Committee. He's supposed to be here to present a bill. Do you have a cell number for him? Excuse me?
Up into the mic. Everybody can hear it on record.
Okay.
Chairman?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Senator Regeer stepped out of the room, Senator Sands.
Show him.
I'll move to pass Resolution 48. Press back in.
I can hear you laughing, Senator Ress.
Jason, is there a different link for state admin?
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Senator Sands.
I was going to ask, since we're waiting for the sponsor, and I was going to request a few minutes for executive action, before executive action, to do a little mini caucus. You want to just structure that now while we wait for Senator Howard? They take a 10-minute break and come back and...
He just showed up, Senator.
Oh, we did. Okay, thank you.
Next, we'll go to Senate Bill 173. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, committee, for letting me stand in front of you. My name is David Howard, Senate District 29, which just happens to be the best Senate district in Montana, and I want to warn you that I'm prejudiced. Today I bring you Senate Bill 173, and you've seen others of these come by here. It is at a revising emergency and disaster services. And essentially, if you look at the bill, if you look down at line 24 on the first page, it essentially says that we are changing, this bill changes, emergency disaster up to 60 days. And what we're doing here is this. We're making it so that after 60 days, the legislature has a vote to whether it continues. So if you look at page 2, a state of emergency may not continue longer than 60 days unless continuing conditions of the state of emergency exist, which must be determined by a declaration of the legislature by joint resolution or a poll of its members of the legislature. The whole purpose of what I'm trying to do with this bill is I'm trying to bring the legislature, the people's house, both Senate and House, into the process so that their elected officials, other than just the governor, get to choose whether we continue an emergency or disaster situation. And with that, I'll sit for questions, and thank you.
Thank you. Are there any proponents, Senate Bill 173, in the room? Proponents, 173, in the room? Online, we have proponent Bruce Spear.
Mr. Chair, Bruce Spear is not online.
Okay. Okay, no proponents. Any opponents in the room? Opponents? And none online. Informational witnesses in the room? And none online. Committee, questions? Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Chairman. This is for the sponsor, Senator Howard.
Chair, Senator Friedel.
Good morning, Senator. Question, on line 19, when you crossed out 30 and went to 60, was there any, can you give me the rationale in regards to why you changed that to go from 30 to 60?
The reason I did is this, is I felt as though that I wanted to give the governor the ability to be able to react to an emergency or disaster. There's fires in Montana that have lasted longer than 30 days. So, but then if it continued more than that 60 days, I wanted the legislature to have a vote, to have a word into it. As you know, in this past pandemic, because of the fact that the law was written that as long as the president kept us into a state of emergency, we were kept into a state of emergency, and we, the legislature, the people's house, didn't have a vote. And I felt as though they needed to. I can tell you if we have a fire, a disaster like that, and it continues more than 60 days, I mean, we can contact the legislature and go another 60 days. That was my reasoning.
Thank you.
Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor.
Go ahead.
Chair, Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howard, you know, the lines in this bill that really disturb me are when you cross out, like on line 20 on the second page, that a declaration of an emergency by the President of the United States, that you're in fact nullifying you can't nullify the power of the president to declare an emergency, but you've crossed it out of here as something that the state of Montana would not recognize. I don't understand that because, I mean, the president of the United States has the well-being of the entire country at their heart, and certainly if it's a national emergency of that kind of, which is rare, but if they do that, I think it is the authority of the president to do that. And I want to know why you think that we should not be listening to the rare declarations from a president who is concerned about the health and safety of the entire country.
Well, I personally believe that the state of Montana should be able to decide. If the president thinks that we have a state of emergency, I can't even think of a governor that probably would not initiate a state of emergency. But after it goes 60 days, this House and Senate gets to vote if it continues. I think it has to do a lot with just plain states' rights. That was my reason.
Go ahead,
Mr.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up on that. You know, there's so few cases in which a federal emergency is named. It is for, I think we have to think beyond the current debate about the current pandemic issues, but situations of war and many other things where the president's authority, as we know, federal supremacy is the balancing act between that and states' rights. And I agree there's a tension there. I certainly have sided frequently with the states against federal government on a number of issues. But the compelling authority of a president to declare a state of emergency, not a policy issue, but an actual emergency, I think you need to think about how you balance that. And so my concern here is, why would you still cross that out and leave that solely to the authority of a state? Could you really explain that? Because I think that's a dangerous road to go down.
Well, I think I explain it this way. I believe that whoever the people in Montana elect as their governor will decide rightly whether they want to follow a national emergency or not. And I think it should stand with the people. And just because the president says what he wants to have happen, I don't believe he actually even has the authority to force Montana to do it. I want to give the people of Montana, their elected people, their governor, their House, their Senate, a voice.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Howard. We actually have a very fundamental disagreement on this topic.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator.
I close. Thank you very much.
Next, we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 172. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's been so long since I've been here. My name is Senator David Howard, and I'm from Senate District 29. And today I bring you Senate Bill 172. It is an act generally revising emergency and disaster laws, prohibiting discriminatory action by the government, providing for civil relief, providing definitions. And essentially, if you want to know what all of this bill is about, go to page 2, line 16. Ensure the continuity of religious services as essential services to the welfare of the people of Montana. And then if you go to limitations and go to the next page, 3, you can read line 8. And this is where it says, limit religious services except that religious organizations may be required to comply with the neutral health, safety, and occupancy requirements that are applicable to all organizations or businesses providing essential services. That in itself is all this bill is trying to do. And with that, I'll sit down for questions.
Okay. Do we have any proponents in the room? Proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, Jeff Lasloffy, Laszloffy, with the Montana Family Foundation. We rise in support this morning of Senate Bill 172. We want to thank Senator Howard for bringing it forward. And I would say your timing is perfect for hearing this bill. We just had yet another ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday on the same exact issue. And I would note that it was a 6-3 ruling. So all across the United States, we've seen governors that have overreached. In the area of a pandemic, we understand that First Amendment rights, constitutional rights, are not suspended during things like pandemics. They may be suspended during things like martial law, but they are not suspended because of pandemics. The purpose of this bill is to protect the constitutionally guaranteed rights of churches and to avoid the confusion surrounding government actions during things like the COVID pandemic. We're going to bring clarity. And all this does, if you look, the bill's 6 pages long, but it's extremely simple. It just inserts church rights, basically religious rights, into existing law that deals with natural disasters. Montana Family Foundation is in a little bit of a unique position. As soon as the pandemic lockdown restrictions went into play in Montana, our phone began ringing off the hook because we regularly provide churches with legal counsel. And churches began calling and saying one of two things: either we're mad and we shouldn't have to do this because the government is stepping on our First Amendment rights to free exercise of religion, or the churches were saying, we want to be team players, we want to do what's right, and we need clarity. And the first pandemic lockdown orders that went out didn't speak to churches. They declared certain businesses to be essential businesses, but they didn't specifically speak to the rights of churches. And so what we had were grocery stores, hardware stores, liquor stores, all allowed to remain open, and churches in this nebulous area, but alluding to the fact that they probably are not allowed to remain open. And so we had pastors calling and saying, where are we in this? What should we be doing? They called the governor's office. We had one pastor that called the governor's office 3 times, spoke to 3 different people, and got 3 different answers. So all this is saying is, if you are going to declare certain entities in society to be essential during a disaster or pandemic, churches cannot be treated any differently. Churches have to be treated exactly the way all of the other entities are treated. Not special, just equal. There's many court cases, as I said, that have come forward as a result of this. Most of them out of California. California not only issued draconian lockdown instructions related to churches, but I would say punitive at the same time. The courts have recognized this, and the efforts in California have been struck down repeatedly. In Montana, 166 different members of the clergy from different denominations wrote a letter to the governor and said, we need clarification because we're getting different answers from your office than we're getting from the local health departments in the state. And we need government to be speaking with one voice during this pandemic. Like they said, they wanted to be team players, but they needed clarity going forward. That was important. When we looked at the restrictions for Yellowstone County that were put in place by the Yellowstone County Health Department, our attorney, and this was specific to a question from a pastor who wanted to televise his services, but he said, if I'm standing in the pulpit, there needs to be somebody running the camera gear. But he said, are we allowed to do that? And when we read these restrictions, our attorney's opinion was, these are so restrictive that you will probably be in violation of the pandemic restriction ordinance if you have 2 people in the church. Now, eventually, it took some time and we got beyond that, but I think that we could have gotten beyond that much more quickly had this language been in code and had we not been running and gunning and just trying to do what was best for the day. So that said, Mr. Chairman and members, we think this is as important. We know that there's probably going to be other issues going forward in the future. This would address them all. Simply says, if you're going to place restrictions on churches, then they must be the same restrictions that are placed on any other entity out there. Churches should not be treated differently. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents, you can go ahead and line up. That would be great. Would save time walking across the room. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Chad Hessler, H-E-S-L-E-R. I'm senior pastor of Cannon Ferry Road Baptist Church, and I also serve as a chaplain within the Air Force Air National Guard here in Montana. I'm a proponent for this bill. I hope that you guys would take this into great consideration. I'm 11-year active duty service member as well, and there was 2 things that I learned on my 4 deployments to the Middle East in various regions. There were 2 essential entities that I relied on. Number 1 was a medic. And when you're in that areas of crisis and you're in the areas of pandemics, lots of times you're crying out for a medic. That medic was to be brought forth to help bring comfort and to comfort that sailor, that comfort that airman, the Marine, the soldier. And then there was a second one right behind, regardless of religion, and that was the chaplain. And the whole purpose of that chaplain was to bring hope. You're going to make it through. Let me pray with you. Let me help you out. Everything's going to be okay. Unit's going to be all right. And you had that beacon of hope. In the areas of church, my theology tells me that a church is made up of 10 or more members, each practicing their spiritual gifts. And that camaraderie, that collective idea of worship, that idea of singing praise, praying over one another, holding hands, holding one another, hugging, or as Paul would say, the holy kiss, it brings a sense of hope as well as a sense of comfort, both emotionally, spiritually, physically, and mentally as well. And so I believe that the churches are to be essential. They should be the first ones that are opened in a moment of crisis, in a moment of pandemic. They should be a gathering place of many people of different diversities, different denominations, different understandings, and coming together, bringing hope to a nation that is hurting, a hope to a nation that is dealing with whatever pandemic and crisis that we find ourselves in. So thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carolyn, Carolyn. Last name is Truscott, Truscott. In a year of tyranny, mandates, dictates, and ever-changing science, our ability to gather and be with faith-minded people was never more important. I thank you for being proactive and protecting our God-given and constitutional rights as they are continually and insidiously being attacked. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 172. Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Donna Elford. That's E-L-F-O-R-D. I come in support of this bill. In 2020, our church began what was called the Hope Center. I couldn't help but my ears perk up as you were talking about all the centers, all of the rehab places. That's what the Hope Center here in Helena is. It's not a rehab center. It's a center to bring women to relearn life. It's crucial. It's very crucial because when you become somebody that has been addictive, you forget what normal is. And so this part of our church is a very important thing. It's very important for us to meet with the ladies. It's very important for us to be family to those who have possibly terminated their relationship with their family because of addiction. I am a realtor, and I was listed as an essential person, and I thank you for that. But my church is more essential than me selling houses. Bottom line, it just is. There is so much that the church body does. Not only are they there to go and comfort those that are hurting, not only are they there to encourage those that are hurting, but they're an active member of the community that reaches out to those that fall through the cracks that there aren't programs for. And for them to not be deemed essential is incredible. In 2020, September, my husband and I both contacted COVID. It was my church body that brought me food. It was my church body, my family too, but it was also my church body that gave me, oh, you should be taking zinc. Oh, you should be taking vitamin D. Oh, you should be doing tonic water. My doctor didn't tell me those things. My church body did. Just telling you. Church is very, very important. It's not just a nice little bringing in the sheets. It's so much more than that. It's so much more than. It's an incredible, intricate part of our life. And I urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Philip Finger. F-I-N-G-A-R. This country was formed one nation under God. God has been with this country through every pandemic, every war, every situation. The doors of the church has been open. And I'll be damned if I'm going to have some bureaucrat, federal, state, or local, tell me that they're going to close the doors of my church. That is simply unconstitutional. And by gosh, we are not going to have this. We are in support of this bill for a reason, because we have a God, an infinite God, who protects all who believes. Please vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kriegel. That's K-R-I-E-G-E-L, representing Americans for Prosperity, Montana. We stand in support of SB 172 for First Amendment rights and rights of free association. In this age of COVID and perhaps other disasters that might visit us, we have learned that connection with people is critical. The perhaps unintended consequences of people being isolated has led to increased incidences of depression, drug abuse, family abuse, and all kinds of societal problems. We believe that religious institutions, in fact, we believe that businesses, for-profit, non-profit, charitable organizations, religious institutions are essential. They're essential to the people who own the businesses, who run these places of worship, and to frequent them. So for these reasons, we stand in support of SB 172. And, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for not being here for the earlier bill. I was outside waiting to be notified of the end of the previous confirmation hearings. We also stand in support of SB 173. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Vice Chairman, my name is Bob Leach, L-E-A-C-H. I rise in support of this bill. First of all, it shouldn't even be necessary. We are guaranteed under our Constitution free speech, and yet we are told to bow to political correctness. So anything that's said that someone doesn't agree with is suddenly hate speech. Some of the proclamations that have been signed by our president worry me a great deal. If he's going to make a declaration, whether it's a health declaration or any kind of a declaration, we need to be very careful. And even if the governor does go along with it for a 60-day period, the legislature has to protect the people. We are guaranteed freedom of assembly, peaceful assembly. There's no place more peaceful assembly than in a church. And yet, they seek to take that away from us with this pandemic thing. It's all right to have an abortion, but it's not all right to peacefully assemble. This really worries me. It's an overreach of the state and the federal government. Freedom exercise of religion is guaranteed under our Constitution. We shouldn't even need this bill or any other bill. And yet we have to have it. So I stand in support of this bill, and in support of our Constitution. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the board, thank you for allowing me to speak in support of SB 172. I think it's important to bring up that earlier.
Could you give us your name first?
I'm sorry. John Hoffa, that's H-O-F-F-A. Earlier, Officer Smith, I believe he was captain of the Highway Patrol, he was up here under scrutiny of how he treated the citizens as far as the Constitution goes. And I think that goes along with how churchgoers are treated by going to church. We have the constitutional right to go to church, freedom of religion, and I think we should be treated as such. I'm glad to say that none of us were hauled away and or arrested or harassed by any of the law enforcement. I know lots of churches closed because of their fear factor, but we stood strong and we were not harassed beyond that as far as going to jail. But I just want to let it be known that we should be treated just the same with our rights as the Constitution. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents in the room? Proponents online, Gregory Chopfune.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. My name is Greg Chaffwin. That's spelled C-H-A-F as in Frank, U-E-N. I am a licensed attorney and a legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, the world's largest nonprofit organization defending religious liberty. I've had the opportunity to review this bill, and I would like to just take a moment to offer a few comments and support. The most important benefit that I see in this bill is that it protects the rights of Montanans to worship and to exercise their faith, especially during times of emergencies. And the bill ensures that churches and other religious organizations receive equal treatment during an emergency and ensures that they will not be treated any worse than other businesses that the state allows to open. The bill would also ensure that state agencies and local governments cannot discriminate against religious organizations on the basis of their religion. I'd like to quickly offer three reasons why I believe this committee should approve the bill. First, religion, as we've heard already, religion is very important to Montanans and indeed to all Americans. Worship services are an integral part of the exercise of religion, and many religious organizations, as we've heard today, provide vital services that are needed by thousands of people in the state. Second, we need to protect the free exercise of religion, especially during crises, because religious operations, they provide vital sources of support to people and their communities. So one way to protect religious organizations and their activities is by not treating them any worse than non-religious activities and operations. And that's exactly what this bill does by ensuring that they won't be treated any worse or that we will treat them at least as well as we treat other organizations and businesses that are allowed to open. And finally, states should not discriminate against religious organizations on the basis of their religious identity. And now, this is not only fair, but it's also mandated by the U.S. Constitution, which has been made clear by the Supreme Court recently in two cases, Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza, where the court made clear that states cannot discriminate against religious organizations merely on the basis of their identity as such. So this bill helps ensure that state agencies and localities will not punish religious organizations for engaging in the free exercise of religion. And for these reasons, I would recommend that this committee approve the bill. Thank you.
Next, Matthew Brower.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Brower, B-R-O-W-E-R, and I currently serve as the executive director of the Montana Catholic Conference. I speak on behalf of the two Roman Catholic bishops of Montana, and I'm here today to voice our support for Senate Bill 172. Over the past year, the COVID-19 pandemic has reminded many of us of just how precious are those freedoms we in this country have too often taken for granted. It has also highlighted the important role government plays in safeguarding public health and safety, and the tremendous responsibility our elected officials have in exercising their offices in a manner that serves the common good. Stories from around the country have reminded us how government actions can, intentionally or not, restrict the exercise of religious freedom. For a significant number of Montanans, the past 11 months have presented challenges unlike any we've encountered in years, And the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual toll it has taken on all of us is not yet fully known. However, throughout the darkest times of the pandemic, many people have found strength, support, and connectedness in their faith communities. These communities and places of worship have helped sustain countless Montanans, providing hope, joy, and a sense of purpose at a time when those have seemingly been in short supply. In other words, religious exercise has provided something essential, feeding the souls of people of faith and empowering and compelling them to reach out to their neighbors in need. Religious freedom is one of our fundamental rights, built into who we are as human persons and embraced in our nation's founding principles. Senate Bill 172 commits our state to protecting those principles by ensuring basic protections for religious exercise during times of public emergencies. By so doing, Senate Bill 172 helps to preserve not only a treasured right, but one which will help us to navigate with grace, hope, and peace the grave challenges that future crises could present. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on behalf of the Montana Catholic Conference, I urge a do pass, and I thank you for your time.
Any other proponents in the room? Okay, opponents. Any opponents in the room? There are none online. How about informational witnesses in the room? None online. Committee, any questions? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Laszlofy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Laszlofy, I'm curious about the notion of neutral limits. If the governor, if we're using the COVID example here, were to say that no matter who you are, whether you're a business, individuals, a church, you know, couldn't have a gathering of more than 30 people at one place, or that everyone had to practice social distancing, everyone had to wear masks, would that apply to churches within the context of this bill?
Within the context of this bill, yes, it would. Now, there could be broader constitutional implications that could be addressed through the courts, but through this bill, that would. Whether or not, I would argue that hardware stores are not on the same constitutional footing as churches. They're not mentioned in the Constitution, but churches are. And so I think the protections, from my point of view, for churches go far beyond the protections for other normal businesses, but that would be something for the courts to decide. They have to at least be treated equally.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Laszlofy, I just want to be super, super clear about this. Within the context of this bill, if we were to pass it, if there were limitations like the ones that I listed that were, you know, not saying that essential businesses or these other sort of groups have to follow different prescriptions, if everybody was required to do the same thing, that would apply to churches as well in the context of this bill if we were to pass it?
That's correct. The problem was with the way that the pandemic limitations and restrictions were rolled out, there were entities out there that were treated far differently than churches, and we were picking winners and losers. And churches should never be on the losing end. So it's important to understand that the bottom line is, if you're going to treat an entity one way, you cannot restrict a church to a greater degree than the way any other entity is being treated under a disaster or pandemic.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think also for Mr. Laszlofy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Laszlofy. I know that you have been working extensively on religious freedom issues for years, for decades. And so could you talk a little bit about in the bill, I don't know if you... If you have it in front of you, page 3, lines 11 through 13, compelling government interest, we're adding that very strong language. And so I don't have a law degree, but I've been doing my best over the last 5 years to really wrap my mind around this. So I know that a compelling government interest is the highest legal standard that can be applied when a court is looking at I would say a constitutional issue. You've made the case that churches have, you know, stand on very strong constitutional ground, more so than other types of businesses maybe. And as a person of faith myself, I do understand.
Senator, do you have a question there?
Yeah, I was going to ask Mr. Laszlavy to speak to compelling state interests, but if I could just finish, as a person of faith myself, I do understand the concerns here, and I know that Mr. Laszlavy has extensive experience, so could you speak about that specific line and why it's in the bill?
Certainly. Senator Gross, Mr. Chairman, so I used to vice chair the House Judiciary Committee, and we all got to play lawyer, and just like you do here, and I think we should probably, after serving for years on these committees, be granted honorary law degrees. But I'm actually not a lawyer. And so I think, and your question is a great question. And what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, Senator Gross, is to defer that question to an actual attorney that does First Amendment law. And I think we have one online from Alliance Defending Freedom.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Chofuen.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chofuen, I will just restate the question very succinctly. I'm looking at the bill, page 3. It's new section 5B, and I'm curious why compelling government interest is inserted as the language in this bill. Please. Thank you.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. This language is the strict scrutiny standard, which arises whenever there's a challenge to a violation of a First Amendment right. And so in this case, the bill is protecting the rights of people to freely exercise their religion protected by the First Amendment. And if that is going to be violated, then it rises to the strict scrutiny standard. And that is why this is here. But as was said earlier, you know, this bill allows neutral health standards to apply. And I think was correctly answered before, a solid cap across the board for all entities to be barred at 30 people. If that's neutrally applied across the board, that would stand. But if there's anything that would substantially burden a particular religious organization, that religious organization can still make a claim that their free exercise rights are being violated. And the state can overcome that by showing that they satisfy the compelling state interest, which could be, you know, the health of its citizens. And then it just needs to show that by applying the law in this instance against that religious organization, that religious exercise, that it is furthering that compelling government interest. And this bill is not saying that there's going to be solid answers, you know, out of the gate. And it's not saying that religious organizations have a blank check to do whatever they want. This is saying that religious organizations just can't be treated any worse than other organizations. And if there is any dispute about their free exercise of religion, then that can be brought to the courts to then resolve the dispute.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chofuen, thank you so much for the legal analysis of that language. Does inserting this language into statute pave the way for cases to more easily come before the court and for the court to rule in favor of a religious organization?
Well, what it does is it ensures that the rights of religious organizations to exercise their religion is protected. And so in that sense, you know, yes, it allows them to vindicate their rights in the court of law. I wouldn't be concerned with a hypothetical situation of an avalanche of cases being brought. I don't imagine, you know, there has to be a case or controversy to bring a case. And that would only arise if the state began, you know, violating the constitutional rights of these religious organizations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Chofuen.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chofuen, are Indian Native American worship included in this bill?
Senator Weber, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your question. Yes, you know, this protects the free exercise of religion as protected by the Constitution, which protects all religions in this country.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chofuen, it says here, well, under page 4, I'm just looking at page 4, it says a house of worship. And Native Americans do not have a house of worship. Is this only applies to churches and mosques and shrines and synagogues and temples? How does that fit into this bill?
Senator Weber, Mr. Chair, that would fall under the sub B, so religious organization, the second meaning, which includes religious groups and associations, whether or not they're affiliated with a house of worship. So yes, that they would also be included by this bill.
Thank you for clarifying that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, a question that hasn't been asked. The last new section added here, protections from government discrimination, talks about taxation issues. I don't understand why this is in the bill. If the sponsor could please answer that question or redirect it to someone who can answer that.
Which section are you on, Senator Sands?
Section 5. When you get into points 1, 2, and 3, they're about tax treatments, taxation, and other sort of financial issues around grants and taxes. Someone could address that, please.
Senator Howard, do you want that or to Mr. Chafwin? Okay, Mr. Chafwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair. Yes, I can talk to that. That is just talking about addressing the issue of types of actions that can be taken against religious organizations. And the tax status is something that, you know, religious organizations do not want to lose the tax-exempt status. And so that is why it's included as one of the possible discriminatory actions against religious organizations. And in answering that question, I would also just point out that this is saying that on account of the religious activity, the free exercise of religion as protected under the free exercise clause, that the state could not take that kind of the state agencies and localities cannot take action against religious organizations on the basis of free exercise practices, not across the board ban on changing tax law related to religious organizations, only by discriminating against them when they are engaging in the exercise of religion.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Could he cite what that has to do with the focus of this, which is related to emergency and disaster laws, how taxation comes into play with emergency and disaster laws? I think this is an awfully broad topic for this bill.
Vice Chair, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. Yeah, it dovetails with the issue that this bill is addressing, which is the disparate treatment against religious organizations that we've seen over the past year. And this codifies the Supreme Court's decisions in Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza that made clear that states cannot discriminate against religious organizations because of their religious status. And so this section of the bill dovetails with the current jurisprudence and protection of religious liberty that's going on in the country.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask some tax people to have a look at this because I don't understand the relationship to this topic of the emergency issues. And taxation is not the topic of this or expertise of this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator McGilvery.
I would have another question for Mr. Chafin.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chafin, on line 12, this is page 3 of the bill. It talks about the least restrictive means. And I would just want your thoughts on, is there a legal definition of least restrictive, or is that more subjective?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, that is something that the courts have jurisprudence as to what they follow when they're making that determination. Least restrictive means is a standard test that is applied in the court of law.
All right, thanks.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator, you may close on your bill.
Thank you for the great questions. I want to make a point. In Section 5 of this bill, the title is Protections Against Government Discrimination. And what it does is it lays out that they cannot affect the tax status. That's all this is saying. I want to tell you that during this COVID crisis, I've gotten multiple questions from churches. And the question was, if we have a First Amendment right, how are they doing this? And they referred to everything from New York to Nevada, where you could go to the casinos, but you couldn't go to church. We did some of the same things here in Montana. As the proponent said, this clarifies things. It puts it in law so that we don't have to have all these questions. It doesn't set churches above, but when you look at our Declaration of Independence, and then when you look at our Constitution, and you read the Federalist Papers, there's a compelling reason they made the First Amendment the first one. It was the most important. That is the compelling reason that we need to protect religious organizations. And I thank you, and I thank you very, very much.
This ends a hearing on Senate Bill 172. Committee will go into executive action in 10 minutes. We'll start with Senate Bill 145 and then do the Senate resolution on the water judge from yesterday and then the two that we had this morning. So we'll be back in 10 minutes for recess.
concerning me.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I have my needs.
What she's doing.
Sometimes arguments are the fact
that Jason, do the Zoomers have this?
Okay,
you ready? Okay, committee, let's be in order, please. If you'd take out your information on Senate Bill 145. Go ahead, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would move due pass on Senate Bill 145.
Committee, this was a bill by Senator Fitzpatrick requiring homeowners association and condominium associations to allow meetings by remote means. And there is an amendment. And Mr. Vice Chair, you might as well move that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move SB 145.1.1.
Anyone not have that amendment? Simply what the amendment does is puts audio on line 24 after telephone to make sure that it's telephone audio and not texting. So it clarifies that. Any questions, comments on the amendment? Okay, let's try a voice vote on the amendment 145.1.1. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move SB.
Manzella, proxy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Manzella, aye by proxy.
Okay, Senator Manzella's aye by proxy. Okay, passed unanimous. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 145 as amended.
Okay. Questions, comments? Senate Bill 145 is amended once. Okay. Let's do a voice vote on Senate Bill 145 as amended once. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
That was you. Okay.
And
Senator Manzella, aye by proxy.
Yay. Senator Gross was a nay. The rest were aye. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
make sure our secretary's caught up. You're all good now? Okay. And that passes 10 to 1. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Resolution Number 12 due pass.
Okay. This was Stephen Brown. We had his hearing yesterday for Associate Water Judge. Comments, questions on SR 12? Senator Brown.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a member of the Water Policy Interim Committee, anytime that Mr. Brown has appeared before us, and you know, he is more than qualified for the position.
Okay, and I think I heard Senator Sands ask for the question. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Manzella, aye by proxy.
Okay, it passed unanimously. Go ahead, Tom.
Mr. Chair, I would move SR 48 due pass.
Okay, Senate Resolution 48 was Mr. Hurd, Boards of Pardons and Parole. Questions, comments on this resolution? Senator Sands?
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak about this. While this is a fine gentleman, he is currently serving on the board. But I've got to say, the issues that we've been hearing continually during the interim and elsewhere is that the Board of Pardons and Parole are not moving forward in any kind of innovative way. They are a bottleneck at this point to getting people out into the community safely. And he doesn't appear to be as innovative as I would like to see. It's more same old, same old. And same old right now relative to the Board of Pardons is not sufficient. I intend to vote no.
Okay. Any other comments? Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Chairman. I would have to concur with the good Senator Sands in regards to the same old, as I have made statements in regards to this particular gentleman. I don't think it's the gentleman, but I think it's the atmosphere of the board that it needs to really have a conversation about at least evening out or having a best served each community with an even out of all these parolees, because I think the disparity in my area alone shows that there is a bigger concern than I have, especially when resources in my area are limited in this situation. So I will Wells be a no.
Senator Heimbaugh.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think we're digging into policy here. That's our place to make policy. I think the board does what they're supposed to do, and who knows for sure what should happen with every released prisoner, I guess. I think we're trying to make policy, and we can't do that because trying to make them make policy because they don't have the cash to do it because we haven't given them the cash to do it.
I would agree. And just, Senator Friedel, I know that your area does have a lot of these pre-release centers and whatever, and up in the Northwest, they're none. So where are they going to put them? They put them in your community. So I really don't think it's Mr. Hurd. I do agree. It's us, probably. We need to address that. Senator Heimbaugh?
I would like to make another comment there.
Go ahead.
I think, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think Yellowstone County promoted that. They done it on the economic, for economic reasons. That's what they did. And so that's why they have these places there. So that's what happens.
Okay. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw Mr. Hurd as being very qualified to do the job that he's asked to do. I don't know that it's the board's job to create the program. It's the board's job to examine the parolee and decide if they are eligible for a certain type of program. I don't believe it's their job to create that program or to particularly assign them to one place or the other. I think you start putting them into a position where they are all of a sudden going to create policy or here's the type of program we're going to create, so we're going to push a lot of people into that. I think they need to be kind of somewhat unbiased on what program they're pushing those people to and actually move them to the program that is the best for them when that program is available. I don't believe it's their job to create it.
Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've gotten in trouble before for speaking for Eastern Montana. And I'm not insinuating that you were speaking for us, but making an observation, Senator Heinbaugh. But I do have to say, Billings has responded to a need in our community. And I cannot say, I think Senator Friedel has been more involved, very involved at the local level. But our community has been responding to a need. And part of that need comes from the fact that, for a long time now, parolees have been coming to our community. And again, we go back to this budget idea, but that the money just isn't there to now provide resources for all the folks we need. So I would again echo the comments of Senator Sands. I really liked Mr. Hurd, and he is somewhat of a local hero. But to the point of hearing, well, this is how we're doing it, and I think that we do need to see some change on the board. So, and that does have something to do with the composition and the members themselves. Well, I take the points well about, the board is following the policies that we set. However, I wanted to echo the comments and speak on behalf of my community. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else?
Question. Okay.
We'll do a roll call vote on SR 48.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes, by proxy.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
No.
Senator Gross?
No.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
6 members have voted aye. 5 members have voted no.
Mr. Chair, I would move to pass on SR 49.
Okay, SR 49 was the post nominations that we heard this morning. Any questions, comments on that? Senator Friedel?
Oh, apologize. I was moving my mic, but I'll let the good senator over there speak.
Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to correct for the record, and I told Sheriff Slaughter that I would do this. I was, in fact, looking at someone else's resume when I asked him about his prior training and the time frames in which those took place. So I wanted to put that on the record. That was my mistake. I think Pulse serves a really important role. A couple of the nominees, mentioned the rhetoric around law enforcement over the past year, and I think this is the body that certifies all of our all law enforcement in the state. And so I think they serve a really important role. They take, they hear appeals. They can take a certificate away from an officer. But I think the folks that are put forward have good experience. And, I hope that in the future those folks who are working to recruit members of the council will take into consideration, some diversity and the law that Senator Sands mentioned. But I was really heartened to hear about the advisory board that they've built in Cascade County, and that instills in me some confidence that these members are going to make a good faith effort to carry out their duties and represent the entire state of Montana. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I think if people are going to be training officers, they should know the law that we have. And I realize that, MMIW, MMIP is new, but it affects a lot of people. And it just seemed like there was just a little bit of they need a little bit of training themselves in what we're looking at. Thank you.
Senator, I probably encourage you to get a hold of the post people, Perry Johnson, and talk with him directly about that issue.
I will. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Chairman. I wanted to speak in favor of this board. I had the unique experience being on the city council to actually swear or be there for swearing in for a lot of these law enforcement that do go through this particular post training. I had to say they're some of the best, most qualified people that I've ever seen come through. They keep themselves in high regards. They are also very respectful. The only issue I had was more of a policy issue than anything else. I think we as a body need to really discuss on how we can help this particular post-training be expanded so that we can have more qualified officers, because there is a significant backlog in our area, and we have to kind of trade out in and out with other law enforcement entities to get more of our officers in there. So that's a policy issue. But on this situation, these are some of the best people you'll see on the streets helping out our communities and keeping our communities safe. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, motion is to approve Senate Resolution 49, the post appointments. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Manzella, aye by proxy.
Okay, it passed unanimously. Committee, tomorrow we have 3 bills that we will hear starting at 9 o'clock. Anyone have anything for the good of the committee? Senator Esp.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to
tell the committee that when we deal with the resolutions, and maybe we're done with those, but we're actually talking about whether the people that come before us are qualified or not. We kind of wandered into a lot of policy issues this morning that are fun to wander into, but I'm not sure they were completely relevant to the qualifications of the people we were asked to vote on. But that's your call, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we did deviate a little bit, but hopefully people got information they needed. Senator Sands?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the notice about what's up tomorrow. Can you tell me if you've already decided, are we going to have executive action on anything tomorrow and what that bill might be or bills might be?
Possibly 140 that we heard yesterday, and I'd have to look what's left. Maybe these two that Senator Howard had today, if we get time.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Yeah, if you have amendments that you wanted for Senator Howard's bills, be working on that with Ms. Burkhart. Okay. Anyone else? Anything for the committee? All right, we are adjourned.